This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Claire Clark, one of the hosts of the channel, and today I'm speaking to Mara Bookbinder, who is a professor of social medicine and adjunct associate professor of anthropology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, as well as core faculty in the University of North Carolina Center for Bioethics. Dr. Bookbinder is also the author of Scripting Death, Stories of Assisted Dying in America, which was just published this summer by the University of California Press. Mara, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
I wonder if you could begin our interview by telling us a little bit about yourself. So how did you come to do this work?
Sure. The project that really got me started on my research career was an undergraduate honors thesis that I completed when I was at Dartmouth College. And that it was an interdisciplinary project. I sort of never felt like my research interests fit very well within the standard disciplinary curriculum. So I devised this interdisciplinary project that enabled me to probe into the stories that people tell about illness and healing. And through that, I was exposed to medical anthropology. I had actually been a psychology major. But I got very interested in medical anthropology through the course of this project, and I ended up going to Case Western Reserve for a master's in medical anthropology and then on to UCLA for my PhD. And at UCLA, I worked with Linda Garrow, who's a medical anthropologist, and Eleanor Oakes, who's a linguistic anthropologist. And they have worked together really over the past couple of decades to mentor students who are interested in the intersections of illness, medicine, and healing, which is Linda's expertise, and language, narrative, and communication, which is Ellie's expertise. And so it was really a wonderful educational experience for me because I was surrounded by so many peers who were interested in the connections between language and medicine and healing. And I just really absolutely loved my graduate education. And so then I completed my PhD in 2010, and I accepted a faculty position at UNC in the Department of Social Medicine, which at the time I told everyone, this is my dream job. Mm-hmm. And it's still really true. I I sort of love being in an interdisciplinary department. So I'm in a department with other social scientists and humanists and some physician colleagues. And I love that environment. I find it really stimulating. And I had always envisioned myself working in a medical school as well. So it's been sort of a really great place for me to land. And this project that we're talking about today is something that I started working on about 5 years ago. So after my dissertation research was published as a book and after I had been here for a little while.
Yeah. So this is not your first book at all by any stretch of the imagination. Tell us a little bit about how you came to this research.
Sure. So let me tell you a bit about the book itself first, and then I'll sort of tell you how I got here. So the book is about medical aid in dying, which is often known as assisted suicide. And there's sort of a bit of a politics of language that underlies those choices of labels. But essentially, medical aid in dying permits a physician to prescribe a terminally ill patient a dose of lethal medication for the purpose of ending the patient's life. And it's legal in, I believe, 11 jurisdictions now in the United States. And my book tells the story of the implementation of Vermont's medical aid in dying law. And at the time that I started my research back in 2015, it was the state that had most recently legalized the practice. So it was the fourth state in the U.S. to legalize, and there's been this explosion over the past few years. And so the book really kind of tells the stories of the patients, caregivers, clinicians, and advocates who were affected by the law. And I report on interviews that I did with 144 residents in Vermont. I also did a bit of participant observation as well in professional conferences and advocacy events to kind of understand some of the discourses around assisted death. So that's sort of a brief overview of the book. In terms of how I came to write it, so I came to this project through an earlier study of mine that looked at clinicians' adaptations to a new abortion law in North Carolina, which is where I live, of course. And working on that made me really interested in further exploring the intersections between medicine and law. But I wanted to get out of the abortion domain. I didn't want to stay an abortion researcher forever. And I decided to focus on end of life because this area is so heavily regulated by law. And I kind of started talking to some people, trying to get ideas of where I might look. And it was a palliative care physician that suggested to me that medical aid in dying might be an interesting thing for me to look at. And I'm so grateful for this suggestion because it ended up being such a fascinating study. So as I started to think about how I would do this and where I would base my research, there weren't that many options because at the time there were only four states in the U.S. where this was a legal option. I knew I wanted to stay in the U.S. And Vermont made the most sense for a couple of reasons. First of all, it was the state that had most recently passed assisted dying legislation. And my interest was sort of in understanding what happens when laws and policies are new and their significance was still being worked out on the ground and they were being implemented. And so when I started to kind of, I mentioned this because when I started to call some people in Vermont to kind of do some background research, they all told me to go to Oregon. And they said, Oregon's been doing this much, much longer. And I said, well, you know, that's precisely why I want to come here, because I want to understand what happens when laws are new. And the other factor that made this research really why it made sense for me is because I knew it very well. I had gone to college sort of just over the state line. I had gone to summer camp there. I had a lot of contacts there. And so I felt like this was something that I could do, even though I didn't live in the Northeast. So I went for several summers and also some long stretches of time in the winters as well. And in the summertime, I took my family there it was a really wonderful experience for all of us. In terms of the title, it was largely inspired actually by a conversation that I had with a palliative care physician whom I interviewed while I was working on the research. And she told me, we were sort of talking about death and what she understood about her patients' orientations to death as a palliative care physician. And she said, some people really want to plan their deaths and script the whole thing out, while others are content to kind of just see what happens. And it didn't really register with me at the time as sort of a key framing quote for the book as a whole. But a few years later, I was starting to synthesize some of the main themes of the book and kind of think about how I wanted to frame it. And I stumbled on this quotation, and it was one of those moments where everything just kind of clicked into place. And I thought, aha, this is the title. And I liked it because the concept of scripting is so rich and multidimensional. And I had actually done a little bit of work on scripting with my abortion work as well, mm-hmm. from a kind of a different perspective, but thinking about counseling scripts that are used in state mandated abortion counseling. But I like the way scripts kind of evoke notions of social life as a type of performance. And I think this comes into play a lot in thinking about death and planning for death and sort of orchestrating the scene of death. And I write about that in the book. Mm-hmm. I also, as an anthropologist, the concept of cultural script is really important to me. So that's this idea that there are cultural templates that guide our thought and behavior. And I think there are a lot of cultural scripts for death and dying that kind of organize the ways the different societies approach the end of life. And then some of the kind of more mundane examples, like the script pad on which prescriptions for medication are written, and that's really important in this area of assisted death as well. So I think part of what I'm trying to evoke in the book is how scripting death affords a particular type of planning that that positions death not only as an anticipated event, but also imbues it with certain aesthetic qualities. And there's this way in which scripting death through medically aid in dying enables people to avoid some of the messiness of death. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what I am getting at when I talk about the aesthetics of death, the sort of bodily decay and deterioration. And medically aid in dying affords a kind of death that is very peaceful. It's relatively sanitized. It enables people to sidestep some of those final stages of the natural dying process that can be quite messy. And it turns out that I think this is what a lot of people are after when they seek a medically assisted death.
So people coming to read this book might think, is she pro medical aid in dying, or is she anti medical aid in dying? And you have a really fascinating discussion of your methods in which you write about maintaining a methodological and analytical commitment to ambivalence. Can you tell our listeners what that means? And then, how did you come to believe that ambivalence is preferable to neutrality in social science research?
Right. So I think it's important to say at the outset, and I kind of hinted at this earlier when I talked about the language around assisted death. So whether we call it assisted suicide or medical aid in dying, it's a deeply contested and very controversial issue societally. So if you're working on this topic, especially as a researcher, you often hear about neutrality. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I positioned myself when I started the research. I would tell my prospective participants that I was a neutral observer. But over time, I kind of started to become suspicious of this language, in part because there are many professional organizations, professional medical organizations, that have taken a quote unquote neutral stance with medical aid in dying. And I think, and I also sort of saw hospice agencies claim to take a neutral stance on medical aid in dying. And there are times in which that neutral stance can start to seem like a way of avoiding controversy. And sometimes when we're talking about clinical organizations, kind of avoiding helping directing patients to the resources that might answer their questions about medical aid in dying. So I kind of started to see this neutrality at times as a cop out and as a way of kind of disengaging from this really complicated issue. So for me, ambivalence as an alternative to neutrality, it's less a reluctance to take a stance, which is what I see with neutrality, than it's an acknowledgement that your stance can shift over time. And this is really what happened with my own feelings about medical aid in dying over the course of my research. So it was very interesting. When I began this project, I kind of came into it feeling largely supportive of aid in dying, but from a pretty uninformed and naive viewpoint, but I think approached it through the same lens that I had my abortion research, where I sort of felt like, well, I'm pro-choice and clearly I'm in support of this practice. But my views were really challenged over the first summer of my fieldwork, where I interviewed a lot of advocates on both sides of the issue. And I really found the opponents' arguments quite compelling, because we talked a lot about how a lot of the cultural preoccupation with medical aid in dying was actually driven by a fear of death and by a reluctance to get up close with death. And that in many cases, they would sort of explain to me the goals of medical aid in dying could be met in other ways. And I found some of this discussion really persuasive. Now, in my second summer of field work, I spent a lot of time getting the stories of folks who had been through the process and interviewing their caregivers about what their deaths had been like. And that made me realize that medical aid in dying can, you know, make such an incredible positive difference in some people's lives, and that many of their goals cannot be met through alternative means. And so my stance kind of swung back in the other direction. And ultimately, I ended up in a place where I feel somewhat ambivalent. I think this is a really great option for some people, and I'm happy that it exists. But I'm kind of ambivalent about it as a policy intervention, particularly when we lack equitable access to palliative care in this country. And I think if we truly wanted to improve end-of-life care for all Americans, this would not be the way to go, because it's such a small number of people that end up accessing it. So I have like some ambivalence there about the amount of attention that it takes up or the amount of attention that it captivates as kind of a health policy issue, because I think it can be distracting from kind of more basic ways of improving end-of-life care. So I guess to sum up, I sort of see ambivalence as this reflexive, ongoing, negotiated process of continually challenging your views. And for me, this was really essential to developing over time a nuanced perspective on an issue as complex as medical aid in dying.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about Vermont, because the book really does a wonderful job of using sort of rich contextual analysis of Vermont and what you see unfolding on the ground there. And then these larger questions about end-of-life care, about assisted suicide, about euthanasia, about, you know, even what constitutes a good death. So I wondered if you could talk just a little bit about in what ways did you find Vermont to be representative of larger national or international conversations? And in what ways was it really a unique case study?
Sure. You know, Vermont, it's very interesting. It was the first state to legalize medical aid in dying through a legislative pathway rather than the courts or ballot initiative. And so from the very beginning, there was something kind of unique about it. And that was sort of subsequently California used the legislative pathway, and that's no longer been the case. But for national advocates for assisted death, there was a lot of attention on Vermont early on. And there was sort of kind of an interesting history through which the law was passed. It really was the result of a homegrown advocacy campaign. There was basically a group of wealthy retirees that got together and they wanted to have this option for themselves, and they formed an advocacy group and they were able to get the law passed. It took 12 years, but it was a really kind of incredible journey. And there was some involvement toward the end from some of the larger national advocacy groups like Compassion and Choices and the Death with Dignity National Center, but that was really kind of at the end. So it was a homegrown effort, and I think Vermonters are proud of this, and they see this outcome in some ways as attributed to kind of this do-it-yourself Yankee mentality of Vermonters. And so it can raise questions about how representative is the Vermont case, and I've certainly had that question posed to me again and again as I talk about this research. I think, you know, in terms of other states in the U.S. where we have medical aid in dying statutes, historically, they have been largely white, more secular, more progressive, and often with a libertarian streak. All of these attributes are true of Vermont. They may not be especially representative of the U.S. as a whole. I think that's part of why there's been a lot of interest in seeing what happens in California, because it's such a large and diverse state, and sort of seeing which populations utilize their aid in dying law can be interesting for kind of thinking about preferences for aid in dying on a much larger scale. So I think, you know, there are ways in which maybe Vermont is a little bit idiosyncratic, but I really feel that the underlying values that are driving assisted death and that are driving these movements, which, I think really have to do with a desire for autonomy and control over one's death, I think that those are nationally representative. I think, and even to a certain extent, internationally representative. I think there's a lot of the same values that we're seeing globally in looking at how these movements are growing. And so I kind of see Vermont in some ways as this microcosm that can tell us a lot about how this issue is evolving on a broader scale, because there's just been so much legislation in the past, even very recently, Australia, New Zealand, Spain, Italy, Austria. So, you know, I think there are certainly culturally specific elements, and I wouldn't want to minimize those as an anthropologist, but I do think that we can learn a lot from a case like Vermont that we can apply to other settings.
I'd like to talk a little bit about what the motivations of advocates for aid in dying might be. You compare the process of scripting death to the process of writing a birth plan, in preparation for childbirth. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, and what does this process look like, and why do people want to pursue it so badly?
Yeah, I think, well, it, you know, of course, there are many different reasons. I think a common misconception is that people want aid in dying because they are afraid of pain at the end of life. And there's been a lot of research, mostly conducted out of Oregon, suggesting that pain is probably not a primary motivation. It did come up a bit in my research, but not typically as the main driver. Typically, it has to do more with things like a desire to maintain autonomy is kind of the bioethics language that's often used. I prefer to talk about control in the book. But that is to say to have some ownership over the dying process and to be able to say, you know, I sort of would rather not stick around for this last part where I'm going to be in this really diminished state for several days or whatever it is. Or I don't want to stick around if I'm going to need help with toileting and if I'm going to be incontinent. And that's one that comes up quite a lot. So it's really about making choices about what quality of life is acceptable or not if one knows that, you know, you have a terminal diagnosis, and to be able to avoid certain forms of suffering at the end. And often it's psychological and emotional and spiritual suffering more than the bodily suffering. Many also want to avoid depending on others for certain forms of care. And that's where kind of that theme of incontinence that I was referring to a moment ago. I mean, I think that's really huge. They don't want to be a burden on their families in various ways. And that motive is a bit more complicated because it is something I think that is often silenced when, particularly in the advocacy discourses, because it's kind of problematic to say, well, I want to die because I don't want to burden my family, because that can start to raise concerns about whether the choice is voluntary and whether we might want to worry about coercion. And so I think it's been much simpler for advocates to emphasize autonomy and to kind of downplay the relational factors that are really kind of stitched into the fabric of people's social lives and that I think are always influencing these choices, but often go unsaid. And that's something that's been really interesting to me in my research. So in terms of what the death plan looks like and how it compares to a birth plan, I mean, honestly, I think sometimes they're not all that different from a birth plan. I think people are talking about when they want to die, which I guess is less of a choice when it comes to a birth plan, but who they want there, what they want the room to be like, who they want by their side, what kind of an atmosphere they want, what kind of music, prayers, you know, all these things. Some people want a kind of a party. They want all their friends and all their family and a toast at the end. And some people prefer a more quiet and somber mood. I think the plan in thinking about the notion of a death plan, I mean, I don't know that people often write it out and formalize it in that way, but it's something that they put a lot of thought into. The other thing that I would just add there is that in thinking about the concept of a death plan, I mean, a lot of times it's not so much about the death itself when you make this choice, but it's about how you're going to live your final days. And so I think there's kind of this interesting dialectic here in which planning your death frees you up to really live according to your values in those last few days. And so planning the death is also about planning for life and how you want to spend that time. And again, I saw like a really interesting mixture of very meaningful connections with family and friends, and then often some more mundane things like doing your taxes, filling out paperwork, that sort of thing, signing over the deed to your car. And it's really interesting to see how those come together in these final moments.
How prevalent is aid in dying? You deal with that a little bit in the book, in terms of whether this is a viable large scale solution for a lot of the problems that we have with, you know, facing death in the healthcare system in the U.S. How many, do you know how many people have pursued it in Vermont since 2014, 2015?
Yeah, great question. And the answer is it's exceedingly rare. So there have been a couple of reports that the State Department of Health has released, which is a requirement of the law, sort of giving very basic details about utilization. And the first one covered the period from June 2013 through June 2017. And actually, as you noted, nothing really happened for the first year or two that the law was passed. And that's because the law was officially effective as soon as it was passed, but there was no public health apparatus in place yet to regulate it. And so physicians really didn't feel comfortable prescribing until that was in place. And there's sort of a lot of political reasons for why the law was written in that way that I won't go into right now. Mm-hmm. But anyway, when the first prescription was written, which I believe was kind of around the fall of 2014, over that first couple of years, there were 52 individuals that filed the paperwork and submitted it to the state, and 29 of those were known to have ingested the medication, which is actually a slightly higher rate of completion than has been reported in Oregon, which is a bit interesting. Mm-hmm. And then in the second reporting period, which covered 2017 to 19, the number was even lower. It was 34 individuals submitting paperwork, and 28 took the medication. And these reports come out every 2 years, so there will be another one in January of next year. But essentially, I mean, the absolute counts are very low. Vermont's population is right around 600,000. But if you look at the percentages as a proportion of total deaths in the state, they're comparable to what we've seen in Oregon, where the rate for death with dignity has been around 19 per 10,000 deaths. So it's 0.2% of all deaths. So again, I mean, that sort of tells you something about this issue, which consumes so much popular attention and really has taken up a lot of space in the popular media. And yet the absolute numbers of people who use it are small. Now, I would argue that the impact is larger than those numbers, because I think that it puts certain conversations on the table about death and dying and planning for death that wouldn't be there otherwise. So I still think it's a really important issue, and that even if people don't pursue it, it has an impact on kind of the broader cultural conversation about death and dying. But I do think it's important to acknowledge that this is a very small number of people.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I'd like to talk a little bit about physicians' responsibility and some of the controversy around how they should be involved in broaching these conversations. So you point out, and we know that physicians are reticent to even bring up the subject of palliative care or hospice care. But in Vermont, there is this very sort of heated debate about whether physicians should be responsible for offering aid in dying. And you compare it to debates around abortion or gun safety, where different states are kind of regulating what physicians can or cannot say about these charged topics. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I mean, death, it's a taboo subject in the United States to begin with. I think we all know that. And physicians really aren't trained very well to talk about death and dying. They're socialized to cure illness. I have been teaching a class to second year medical students for the past 5 or 6 years, really delving into some of the cultural issues surrounding death and dying. And the feedback that I get from this course is so positive because they say, you know, this is really not something that we have many spaces in our curriculum to address. So I think there's a kind of a significant barrier to entry to begin with, to even bring up the subject of death. In the case of counseling patients about medical aid in dying, there are even further hurdles because there are, I think, justifiable worries that introducing this topic might signal to a patient that you endorse it, or that you're giving up hope for a cure, that, you know, you think all hope is lost. There's really, there's a shift with hospice as well to kind of introducing, okay, now we're at the point where we're really going to talk about end of life options. And for an issue that is kind of politically and morally contested, if you don't, if this does not align with the patient's values, you may risk harm to the relationship if you bring it up, and the patient might feel that that you're endorsing this, and that might be problematic. So it's a very risky conversation. But I have really been suggesting in my work over the past few years that there are ethical concerns with not offering qualifying patients information about this option. And, you know, interestingly, Claire, you said that in the way you framed the question, that there's been heated debate in Vermont about whether or not physicians should kind of counsel patients about this. And it's partially true because there was a lawsuit in 2016-17 that addressed this issue of whether or not physicians had a duty to inform, and the suit was eventually dismissed, but there really actually hasn't been heated debate nationally about this issue, which has surprised me. And a lot of physicians have taken it for granted that one should never introduce this topic and one should always wait for a patient to introduce it first. And the problem with that, that I have been arguing, is that then only patients who already know about it will have access to it. And because more privileged patients tend to already have information about it, you're sort of ensuring that this option is going to be more available to more socioeconomically privileged patients. And so I think if we're saying societally that this is a good option, we're making it legally available, we think for some people it's a good option, then I would say that really it should be available to everyone and not just to more affluent patients, which has been the case kind of statistically looking at Oregon, because again, they have the best data. So I think it's a murky conversation. It's a complicated conversation, but I don't think that we should take it for granted that physicians should simply wait for patients to bring it up. And in fact, when I looked at this empirically with just the very small sample of physicians in my study, we found that about half of the physicians were bringing it up in some cases before a patient did, just to kind of make sure that they were aware of it, which is not to say they would do it for all patients, or, you know, they might not do it if there was a clear signal that the patient would never go for this option. But sometimes they were kind of making their patients aware. In terms of sort of how this compares to talking about abortion or gun safety, I mean, yes, I've done a lot of work on abortion, and so I'm very interested in the way that the state mandates speech around these controversial topics. I think that may be part of what is going on with medical aid in dying, that there may be a political concern about, a physician's political agenda getting in the way of these end-of-life conversations. But really, I think it's less clear that this is what is at stake with medical aid in dying. I think the politics may be part of the picture, but I also think it's just so fraught from the get-go to talk about death in a way that I'm not completely sure is the case for guns. You know, certainly may be so for abortion in certain contexts, but I think what the difference is that like death is so pervasive and it's something that is going to happen to all of us. And yet, you know, that there's this reluctance that we can't only look at, I think, from this politicized lens.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about physicians' role in the process of aid in dying. Because you argue that this process is complex, it's morally fraught. It is not simply writing a prescription for a lethal dose of medication. It involves more than that. And one of the interesting things that the book does is to provide a really rich description of what that looks like in sort of different cases. So how do physicians help script death?
Yeah. You know, there's a quote from a physician in the study that I really love, which, speaking of guns, she says, "You don't just hand them the loaded gun without giving them the gun education." And so I think the point here is that there's a kind of a moral obligation to do a lot of counseling and education around medical aid in dying. And it's quite morally and emotionally taxing for physicians because you want to make sure that if they are going to choose this option, that they're really doing so for the right reasons, that their needs can't be addressed through another means like symptom control, for example, that they fully understand the process. And so you have to explore the reasons for the request and you have to talk about how their family feels about it. So there's a lot that goes into it. And as one physician pointed out to me, I can't bill for this. I mean, there's no insurance billing code for talking about medical aid in dying. If the patient does decide to go ahead with it, there's quite a lot of logistical legwork involved. And I think this is one arena in which Vermont may be a little bit unique, but because it was such a small state and there weren't very many physicians that were doing it, there wasn't kind of a clear pathway for what you actually do when you want to prescribe. So for one thing, the state doesn't dictate what prescription to write and, you know, what the medication is, what the drug cocktail is. So particularly at the beginning, there was a lot of work involved in trying to figure out how do I do this? And sometimes that involved connecting with physicians in states like Oregon and Washington, which some of the advocacy organizations can help arrange. But then you have to figure out what pharmacy is going to fill it. And at times over the course of this law in Vermont, there has been maybe only one pharmacy in the state that's willing to do it. So the physicians had to kind of figure that out. They had to sometimes help the patients navigate the cost. And so it's just a lot of work. And then after that sort of bureaucratic part, a lot of these physicians and also nurse practitioners sometimes and hospice social workers were also involved in planning for the death and figuring out who's going to be there, what kind of backup safety measures might need to be in place if something goes awry, sometimes even attending the death. And not all of the physicians that I interviewed felt comfortable doing that, but several of them were present for the death as well. You know, there's a wide range of ways in which physicians can interface with medical aid in dying, and it's not just writing prescription. And actually, I was really interested in the fact that sometimes writing the prescription was a fairly minimal role. So I interviewed one physician who kind of drew her moral line in the sand at writing the prescription, but she did everything else. She helped find the second physician who's needed, or she helped find the prescribing, she helped find the prescribing physician, and then she agreed to serve as the second certifying physician, which is a legal requirement of the law. She helped figure out the medication, the pharmacy. She helped plan for the death. So she was extremely involved, and yet didn't feel comfortable writing the actual prescription. And I found that really telling, because I think a lot of times the ways this is characterized in the media and also in some of the scholarly literature puts the emphasis purely on the prescription.
I'd like to end by talking a little bit about systemic issues. So we already, you mentioned that it's a relatively small percentage of the population that pursues aid in dying, and that the people who do tend to be pretty well educated and pretty privileged. Tell us a little bit about how attention to aid in dying both exposes and obscures flaws in the healthcare system, particularly around end of life care in America.
Yeah. So one of the biggest findings and takeaway messages of my research was that access to aid in dying is uneven, and a lot of patients encounter barriers. And that's not surprising, I guess, as someone who has been studying U.S. healthcare for a long time, because we see these issues cropping up in all domains of healthcare. But a lot of the issues with aid in dying had to do with kind of with access to a physician who was willing to prescribe the medication, which was a huge barrier for many patients. And I just found that, and by the way, this is not just the case in Vermont, but pretty much every state where medical aid in dying is legal has had some issues with this. And patients that are more socioeconomically privileged have better access. And some of that has to do with the fact that they have better access to physicians' social networks. And that was a factor in Vermont, where it's kind of a small state, and in smaller towns, everyone knows everyone. And so you might be more likely to kind of know someone that knows the doctor that's willing to prescribe. There are some issues with cost as well. You have to be able to pay for the medication, and some insurance companies cover it, but not all of them do. And for anyone that's over 65, Medicare simply won't cover this because there are federal restrictions surrounding using federal funding for anything related to abortion or assisted death. And so, you know, in one case that a physician told me about, she had a patient who was fairly poor and you know, expressed interest in the medication, and she told him that the dose would cost $500, which, to be honest, is much less than what some people paid, because there was a point at which Seconal was the most popular option, and it cost $3,000 for the lethal dose. So there were alternative medication protocols were developed to try to address that cost barrier. But even this $500 for this one patient, he said, oh, you know, absolutely not, forget it. And he actually went on to live a lot longer and do pretty well, which was interesting to see. But, you know, that's like everything in U.S. medicine, this seems to be an option enjoyed by the relatively privileged. And it's used by such a small number of people that I think, as I mentioned earlier, it's just not the best way to give the most number of people better deaths, if we want to think about it from kind of a utilitarian perspective. If we want to give most people better deaths, we improve access to hospice and palliative care for everyone. And hospice is wonderful. They can do wonderful things, but it's still quite hard to access for many people in certain parts of the country. And I think that the advocacy attention that is devoted to medical aid in dying can be distracting. It can distract attention and also money, lobbying dollars, from other kinds of policy changes that would improve end-of-life care more generally. And so I think that's sort of the way in which it can obscure some of these flaws in the healthcare system if we put too much attention on it.
Well, Mara, we have taken up a lot of your time, and we've come to the traditional final question, which is, what are you working on next?
So I have been spending the past 6 or so months on a study that was influenced by the pandemic, because everyone's work is influenced by the pandemic these days. But I have been looking at physicians' experiences providing frontline care for patients hospitalized with COVID-19. And we've just wrapped up 78 interviews with physicians in New York City and New Orleans from specialties like critical care, pulmonology, and emergency medicine, and some hospitalists, sort of looking at the challenges that they've encountered during the pandemic. So it's somewhat of a new direction for me, because I've been thinking a lot about the profession of medicine, and there's a crisis of burnout that really motivated the framing of this research, and that has been such a challenge for physicians throughout COVID. But there are certain threads that I'm pulling through, because we're talking quite a bit about both physicians' moral experience and physicians' experiences caring for dying patients, and their confrontation with the sheer magnitude of death that they are facing has been a really profound theme in the interviews that we've done so far. So we're sort of at the phase of just finishing up the interviews, and I'm really looking forward to diving into the analysis in the coming months.
Well, Mara, that sounds like really important work. Do you think it'll be a book?
I don't know. I'm still kind of trying to wrap my head around all the different articles that need to be written in the short term.
I look forward to reading the results in whatever form, and wanted to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Claire.